or equivalently an affine connection, the Levi-Civita connection, is redundant. There is a lot of redundant information in such a description of a space-time. Consider two pseudo-Riemannian manifolds, a differentiable manifold and a metric tensor on it. And another case is differentiable manifold, let's say the same differentiable manifold, but a different metric tensor on it. It could be that they describe the very same space-time, even though we may not notice. You may be given a differentiable manifold with a metric tensor on it, a matrix-valued function of space and time, and another matrix-valued function of space and time, G prime, two metrics. They may look very different, but they may describe the very same space-time. Namely, if there is a metric-preserving diffeomorphism between the two descriptions. This could be. And by metric-preserving, I mean, of course, there is a diffeomorphism from the manifold into itself, such that the pullback map for the metric tensor maps it into itself. If such a metric-preserving diffeomorphism exists, then we have two differentiable manifolds with a Riemannian metric on it, but we have to consider them equivalent. In effect, the diffeomorphism is then simply a change of coordinates. And clearly, the physics doesn't depend on what coordinates we use. All those descriptions that differ merely by a metric-preserving diffeomorphism, all those changes of charts, really describe the same physical object. Therefore, in mathematics, there is a corresponding concept. Okay, this is just to say that the diffeomorphism has a tangent map, it has a pullback map, which maps two tensors into two tensors, and metric preserving means that it maps the metric into the metric. Remember this business of a diffeomorphism between two manifolds inducing a diffeomorphism, inducing a linear map between tangent spaces and between tensor spaces, and in particular between the spaces of two tensors. Now, as I said, physically, such two manifolds are the same, and therefore we define a corresponding mathematical object. We define a pseudo-Riemannian structure, let's call it capital Chi, to be an equivalence class of pseudo-Riemannian manifolds which can be mapped into each other via a metric-preserving diffeomorphism, which is basically to say via changes of coordinates. So we will model a space-time, to be completely accurate, we will model a space-time not through a differentiable manifold with a metric on it, but through an equivalence class of differentiable manifolds with metrics on them, which are equivalent in the sense that they can be mapped into each other by change of coordinates. They differ only by change of coordinates. They differ only by metric preserving diffeomorphism. So really, a space-time is one of those equivalence classes mathematically. You can pick one element of that equivalence class. It's going to be a differential manifold with a metric. And then, in principle, you can determine all. Now, this might seem like a trivial point, but it's not. It's actually a very leading to a very deep problem. And it starts with the problem that we cannot really get explicitly hold of those equivalence classes. Imagine somebody gives you two metrics. How do you decide whether or not there is a diffeomorphism that maps the one into the other? How do you try out all possible diffeomorphisms? You can't do that. There is no constructive way to check whether or not two Riemannian manifolds belong to the same equivalence class. Of course, you can start with one, with one Riemannian manifold and then generate many others through diffeomorphisms. But the opposite process, given two, finding whether or not there's a diffeomorphism is really difficult. And it turns out that that is translating into a deep problem in quantum gravity. It would be nice if we could, just a sec, it would be nice if we could pick in every equivalence class, in every equivalence class of Riemannian manifolds, exactly one representative, so that we can talk about the Riemannian structures, because these are the physical objects, the Riemannian structures. If we could do that, if we could pick systematically from every one of those equivalence classes one representative, then the language that would be used for that would be that of fixing a gauge. The freedom of representation, freedom to choose any one representative of an equivalence class is also called a gauge. That's in analogy to the gauge principle in the Standard Model of Particle Physics. It's not a complete analogy, but it's almost. And being able to fix, being able to pick one representative out of each equivalence class reliably, just one, so that we're, you know, not more than one out of one each equivalence class, but also not missing any one of the equivalence classes, that ability would be called the ability to fix a gauge. Now, why would that be useful? Why, in fact, is that a necessary skill to have in order to do quantum gravity? So quantum gravity can be done in many different ways, or it can be attempted in many different ways anyway. One, as I said, is to identify curvature by the presence of deficiency angles, that they don't add up to 180 degrees, the angles in the triangle. You can also try to quantize shape instead by checking whether Pythagoras' law is true, or in other words, by quantizing the metric. Or we can try to quantize the non-trivial shape degrees of freedom of space-time by trying to quantize what indicates non-trivial parallel transport, affine connections. Either way, the problem reduces to a problem which, in the path integral formulation, takes this form. We need to perform a sum over all possible evolutions, over all possible ways that the degrees of freedom can evolve. And ultimately, that is probably, if gravity behaves anything like the other parts of physics, it involves assigning an action to a space-time structure, which is to say a pseudo-Riemannian structure. So that any way that the space-time might evolve, any g of x and t, any metric of x and t, or any affine connection of x and t, or any deficiency angles collection for x and t, give us an evolution of space-time, and each one of those will have a probability amplitude, which is e to the power I times the action associated with that. The Einstein action, probably. Maybe with some higher order corrections, but we know it should start with the Einstein action. And then we have to sum over all possible evolutions that space-time can have. And each one of them is a pseudo-Riemannian structure. So we have formally a path integral over pseudo-Riemannian structures, and these are the probability amplitudes. This would give us the analog of the partition function. If we actually want to calculate expectation values, we might have to put whatever observable we want to know over there, correlators and things like that. I'm just putting these things schematically here. Of course, in practice, it'll be more complicated. But this is the basics of it. You see, there's a... Yeah?
So by evolution, do you mean to choose a preferred direction of time?
No, I mean just the... not at all. If, for example, we work with a description of space-time in terms of a differentiable manifold with a metric on it,
that's four-dimensional,
then yes, we would choose a coordinate system in which we then give the metric g mu nu of x and t. And of course, that singles out what is space, what is time. But remember that we're really summing here over Riemannian structures, auxiliary Riemannian structures, which means that we would get the exact same contribution if we expressed that same space-time in a different coordinate system in which you're foliating your space-time differently with respect to space and time. Right? So it doesn't really matter on exactly how you foliate your space-time into space-like hypersurfaces.
So I'm thinking in quantum theory, you have to specify in-state and out-state.
Yeah, I was trying to avoid that. I mean, yes, you can try to quantize gravity the canonical way, and of course there are lots of efforts going into that. But yes, then from the very beginning, you have to single out a time coordinate. And then you have to later show that what you do doesn't depend on which choice you've made. And if you do it in the path integral framework, then everything is covariant to start with. That's actually why I write it in the path integral
framework. What does that number mean physically?
Oh, it's not something that you could actually... You should not take the modulus square of that and interpret that as the probability for that evolution to happen. You know, in second quantization, probabilities don't work that easily.
But then what's the meaning of that number?
Oh, it's just contributing to the partition function.
Oh,
it's the analog of the partition function. If you were to do a Wick rotation of it, then that would be a Boltzmann factor. There would be a minus there. And then you could interpret that as really Boltzmann factors and unnormalized probabilities. But in the Wick rotated version, nobody really knows how to interpret these things. Okay, so this is what we would like to do in principle. But in practice, we cannot. And the reason is, as I explained just a little bit earlier, that we have no handle on those equivalence classes. We don't have handle on those pseudo-Riemannian structures. It would be great if we could, in fact, pick one representative out of each equivalence class and then sum them over. But as it is, if we were to do, if we want to do this, well, in practice, we can only do that. You see, we can do the following. You can write down a path integral where we sum over, let's say, all metrics in some sense. So instead of summing over all Riemannian structures that we cannot write down explicitly, we can write down metrics explicitly. So we can formally write down something like a partition function where we have e to the power is, and the Einstein action is expressed in terms of the metric. And then we are summing over all metrics. But as we do that, we are way over summing here, see, because a lot of those metrics that arise there, if we integrate over all metrics, a lot of those metrics are going to correspond to the exact same space-time, only differing by a change of coordinates. And so we get, in this case, we get twice that contribution. But of course, there are infinitely many choices of coordinates. And therefore, every space-time, if we don't do a Dirac delta in here, every space-time would, every pseudo-Riemannian structure would contribute infinitely many times, in fact, uncountably infinitely many times, to that path integral, which makes it hopelessly more divergent than it is anyway. So what we really need, in order to get that, is to put a Dirac delta here, which fixes the gauge. So we sum over all metrics, but the Dirac delta should peak. Should have a function in here, a gauge fixing condition here, should have a function in here which is zero only once inside each equivalence class, so that this entire path integral here becomes that one. One contribution per equivalence class. Or similarly, if we wanted to do it with the affine connections, just schematically, we would need some Dirac delta in here. But we don't know how to do that. We don't know how to do this Dirac delta. And so what then happens if you don't do the Dirac delta or you do a poor approximation of a Dirac delta, then you are oversumming here. And what that means is that you are in effect quantizing degrees of freedom that are not physical degrees of freedom, but that are just pseudo degrees of freedom, that are just choices of coordinate system. And obviously it makes no sense to quantize choices of coordinate system. Because choice of coordinate system is something we do, not something that nature does.
I'm still quite
Question. Why is this step more difficult than in Young News theory for gauge fixing? In terms of like just this step?
Well, in Young News theory, gauge fixing is just a very easy thing to do. You set, for example, d mu a mu equal to zero, Feynman or Landau gauge, and you're done. It's not completely fixing the gauge. There's a little bit left over, but it can be shown that that's controllable. And that's so easy because, especially in electromagnetism, it's a linear theory. In Young-Mills theory, it's not linear. It becomes a little bit more complicated, and there can be issues there. But GR is hopelessly nonlinear. It's basically because it's a nonlinear problem to find out whether or not there is a diffeomorphism that maps the metric into the metric. It's that nonlinearity of it that makes it too hard. Right, and so if we don't do that properly, then we seem to be quantizing, putting commutation relations effectively, or doing a non-trivial path integral over degrees of freedom that are freedoms we have in choosing coordinates, rather than freedoms nature has in doing the one or the other thing. And that cannot be right. So what can we do? It's a major topic in quantum gravity to overcome that problem. Now, today I'd like to introduce you to a consideration that tries to overcome that problem. The idea is to use spectral geometry. Now, spectral geometry is a discipline of mathematics that's actually older than quantum mechanics and older than general relativity. It goes back to Hermann Weyl in the early part of the 20th century, I think 1904, 1905, or something like that. He didn't have all the ideas at the time, but the basic idea is really simple. The basic idea is if you take a vibrating object, like an empty vase, so if you bang it with a spoon and it will vibrate, then it will make a certain sound. And clearly, if you change the shape of the vase, if you take a vase that has this shape and compare its sound with the vase, with the sound of a vase of a completely different shape, clearly the sound is going to be different. And so a question then is, could it be that from the sound we can tell the shape? So that would be tremendous. And that's because the vibration spectrum would be a geometric invariant, or is a geometric invariant. It does not depend on the coordinate system that you use to calculate the spectrum. The spectrum always comes out the same. And in particular, if you think of space-time itself is always ringing too. You don't even need a spoon for that. Space-time is ringing because of quantum fluctuations. If you could listen to the quantum fluctuations of space-time or the quantum fluctuations of fields that live on space-time, then maybe from listening into that sound, from that spectrum, you can tell what the curvature of space-time is. And again, the description of space-time curvature in terms of eigenvalues, in terms of the spectra of certain wave operators, that's a description in terms of geometric invariance. It does not depend on the coordinate system. So if that were to work, we could try to quantize gravity by quantizing the dynamics of those eigenvalues, of those spectra. And we would then have, ideally, I'm not saying that's the case, but that's what we want to examine, ideally we would have that every spectrum corresponds to one pseudo-Riemannian structure. So a space-time has a spectrum has a space-time. And there's no ambiguity in this. So you wouldn't be quantizing any choices that humans make. You would only quantize the dynamics of space-time itself. It's sort of the Fourier, the idea is to develop a Fourier theory for curvature. Right? Yep.
So, if you have some relative motion between your source of sound and your, say, absorber, there could be redshifts.
Oh, Yeah, it's true, but none of it matters for that purpose. If you take a spoon and bang it onto a vase, it will start ringing. And how it rings will depend on where and how hard you hit it with a spoon. But none of that is what affects the spectrum. You see, how loud the various overtones are will depend on exactly where you hit with the spoon. But what we're interested in here is only what the frequencies are of the overtones, not the amplitudes. The amplitudes depend on the spoon and all of that. But the frequencies themselves are a property of just the manifold, just the shape of it. And so we are not concerned with how the noise is made or how the noise is received. We are only concerned with what the eigenspectrum is.
Doppler shifts, possibly.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there would be a Doppler shift if the vase is ringing and you're listening to it while you are in a state of motion, then yes, there would be a Doppler shift. But the intrinsic overtones of the vase are the only thing that is concerning us here. And those overtones, the spectrum of these overtones, as I will show now, that spectrum is literally the spectrum of the Laplace operator on that manifold. And that's the only thing that matters. It's intrinsic to the manifold. It has nothing to do with the listener, nothing to do with the guy who's wielding the spoon. Okay, so then the key question, though, is, does the spectrum of the vibrating object, or the vibrating space-time, or does the spectrum of waves on a manifold encode all about the shape? If you know just the spectrum, does that allow you in principle to infer which Riemannian structure you work with? Of course you cannot infer what coordinate system you work with, right? It's totally geometrically invariant. Now, clearly this cannot be the case when the manifold is infinitely large. Because if it's infinitely large, then the Laplace operator, or if it's a space-time, the D'Alembert operator, will have a continuous spectrum. And the continuous spectrum would be just R, or the positive real numbers, and that would not carry any significant information. So if we wanted to work with an infinitely large manifold, then we should first take it finite, and then perhaps take the limit of its volume going to infinity. But remember that in cosmology, it doesn't really matter whether it's finite or infinite, because we can always assume the universe, we can just take a chunk out of it, which is a few dozen billion light years across, and that is beyond anything we can possibly see. It's larger than what could possibly affect us. So we can assume without restricting generality that the volume is actually finite. Now, spectral geometry has been worked on now for about 100 years, but mostly for Riemannian manifolds, and I will focus today on Riemannian manifolds too. For pseudo-Riemannian manifolds, it's harder, and you will see why, and it's therefore still quite little developed. But you see, the potential payoff is tremendous, because if you can do it, then you have a very nice way of describing the shape of space-times. Basically, a Fourier transform way of it, which does not rely on coordinate systems at all. Now, the first theorem I'd like to mention is quite useful and powerful for Riemannian spectral geometry. Assume that we are dealing with a Riemannian manifold, so a differentiable manifold has a Riemannian metric, and it is compact, it has a finite volume, and let's say it has no boundary. Then one can prove that the spectrum of the Laplace operators on P forms is discrete. Remember, there is one Laplace operator. Remember, it's d del plus del d. It's the anti-commutator of the exterior derivative and the co-derivative. There's one Laplace operator, and it acts on P forms, zero forms, one forms, two forms, up to n forms. And we can consider, because it's mapping P forms into P forms, we can consider its spectrum on P forms, and then its spectrum on P plus one forms, and so on. And it turns out that all those spectra are discrete, and they have a finite degeneracy at most, and they don't have, the spectrum doesn't have accumulation points. None of the spectra have accumulation points. Now, so this gives us an opening here. It means that if you take a finite size, finite volume, differentiable Riemannian manifold, then there's quite a bit of information we can gain. So think, for example, of, let's say, thin sheet metal, and we've made a shape out of it that looks a bit like a potato. So, you know, irregularly shaped. And it's a two-dimensional manifold, let's say, two-dimensional Riemannian manifold. You can think of it in practice as a thin sheet of metal that's made into that shape. It's hollow. And then we take a spoon to it, and it will ring, and we record the sound. The question is whether from the sound, from the spectrum alone, we can infer what the shape of the potato was. Now, and similarly, we could do it for three-dimensional objects and so on. What we have here is several different spectra, namely the spectrum of the Laplacian on one form, zero forms, etc. What does that mean, physically speaking? Well, physically speaking, it means the spectra of waves of different kinds. See, the spectrum of the Laplacian on zero forms, as I will show in a moment, is telling you the spectrum that scalar waves have on that potato, for example. But on the potato, there may be more than just scalar waves. You can have a scalar field with a Klein-Gordon type of equation, for example, living on that potato. And then the spectrum would be given by the spectrum of the Laplacian. But you could also have, on that potato, you could also have, for example, a vector field living, a field of one forms. And then the Laplacian on one forms acts on that. And you could have electromagnetism living there, and so on. You could have higher and higher spin fields live there. And each one of those fields has its own spectrum. You probably know that in seismology, this is important. In seismology, when an earthquake happens or a nuclear explosion, then they record at many different locations what kinds of waves arrive and when they arrive, with what amplitude, and so on. And they know very well that there are two kinds of waves that they should look out for. There are pressure waves. You see, if the initial earthquake, will have produced some sort of pressure on neighboring rock, and then that neighboring rock presses on the next neighboring rock, and so on. And so there's a pressure wave propagating, and pressure waves have a certain velocity, and they have certain dispersion, and it's all very well measured, and you can use that to measure distances from an earthquake, and so on. But an earthquake will generally produce not only pressure waves, it will also produce shear waves. Think of this as a piece of rock which is not just moving, but it's tilting. Okay, so if it's just moving, it will exert pressure. But if it is tilting, then it will exert a shear onto the neighboring rock. And then that neighboring rock will say, okay, I'll shear as well, and so on. And so you have a shear wave, which is then propagating through the rock. It turns out that shear waves are tensorial, and they have very different properties from the pressure waves. Propagate at different speeds, they have different dispersion relations, a different relation between energy and frequency. And also what's very important is that shear waves cannot propagate in a liquid, like the liquid interior of the Earth, because liquids are defined as materials that do not support shear waves. Right, because there's no restoring force to a shear. And this is how the liquid interior of the Earth was discovered. Shear waves reflect off the solid liquid boundary, whereas pressure waves go right through. They get deflected, but they go right through. So what we see from that is that it's very important to know that different kinds of waves carry different kinds of information about what is going on in that manifold. And so here, in spectrogeometry, we should expect, too, that different kinds of waves, scalar waves, vectorial waves, higher form kind of waves, can carry different kinds of information about the manifold. And so if we want to gain the maximum amount of information about the shape of our manifold, we should be listening to the spectra that we get for all kinds of waves. So we should make sure that the spoon that bangs on the object is not just exciting scalar waves. It should also excite, you know, one-form waves, two-form waves, three-form waves, etc. And then we listen to all those spectra. okay, so what kind of waves would we have? Well, consider p-form fields. Let's call them omega of x. So omega is a p-form. P could be anything between 0 and n. And we give this p-form field time evolution. We could write down a Schrödinger equation, for example, for a p-form field. If it's a zero form, it's just the ordinary Schrödinger equation, but we might as well write it down for any arbitrary p-forms. So it's I h bar time derivative of the p-form field equal to minus h bar squared over 2m, and then here we have the Laplacian on p-forms acting on that p-form field. Or we may want to calculate the propagation of heat on the manifold, and then we have a heat equation like this. Of course, heat is scalar. Therefore, we should really use a zero form, but we might as well consider that heat type of equation also when the form in question is not a zero form, but a one form, two form, p form. Or we might consider a Klein-Gordon equation in order to get, just another example. Klein-Gordon equation for p forms. So here we would have that the second time derivative of that p form matches up to a constant the Laplacian of p forms acting on that p form here. Either way, it doesn't matter which kind of time evolution we want, the heat equation, Schrödinger equation, or the Klein-Gordon equation. What governs the solutions is the eigenfunctions to the Laplacian and the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. And the reason is that all of those equations can be separated. Space variables in one side, time variables on the other side. So we can solve those equations by separation of variables. So assume that we find an eigen differential form, so an eigenvector to the Laplacian. Let's assume we find an eigen form omega tilde of the Laplacian on the manifold. So assume that omega tilde obeys that eigenvalue equation. Well, then if you put that in here, you will see that if this is an eigenfunction to the Laplacian with a certain eigenvalue, then that eigenvalue will determine the frequency with which it oscillates in time, right? Because you have the time derivative times omega equal to a constant, which is the eigenvalue, times the form again, so you get a certain time evolution that's just governed by the eigenvalue, which is to say that the frequencies with which the vibration is happening are governed by the eigenvalues of the Laplacian up to those prefactors there that are really, you know, in those prefactors would be encoded, for example, the stiffness of the manifold. That determines the overall frequency with which the thing will vibrate. But in principle, what governs the frequency spectrum is always the spectrum of the Laplace operator on the p-form. Okay, but do they exist at all? Can we really pull this off? You see, are there always going to be eigen differential forms for the Laplace operators on p-forms? Well, they do actually exist. And that is because the Laplacian, if you remember, is a self-adjoint operator with respect to this inner product. And therefore, since they exist, we have, as I just indicated here, if this acts on that and that's an eigenvector to the Laplacian, well then, the Schrödinger equation or the heat equation or the Klein-Gordon equation takes simply this form for each one of those eigenvectors. We have here that if this is the eigenfunction of the Laplacian, then the time-dependent complete solution to the Schrödinger equation is given by this. Omega is this eigenfunction of the Laplace operator times that, because as I just explained, you know, the frequency the eigenvalue determines the frequency of the oscillation, and for the heat equation it would be this prefactor, and for the Klein-Gordon equation it would be that prefactor. All of this is just to say that the spectrum of the Laplace operator translates literally into the what we think of as the spectrum of vibrations, the frequency of the vibrations, the frequencies of the vibrations. So any object that can vibrate has a bunch of resonance frequencies. They are its spectrum, the spectrum of its Laplacian. So what then is the spectrum of the Laplace operator on p-form? How much information do we get if we measure the spectrum of the various kinds of waves? It doesn't matter whether it's Klein-Gordon or heat or the Schrödinger equation. What really matters is only whether it is a p form or p plus 1 form or p plus 2 form or so, because it's just the spectrum of the Laplace operator that matters. Okay, so we have different Laplace operators, Laplace delta p, and in the case of seismology, we know that pressure waves and shear waves carry definitely very different information. Now let's examine how different the information is that is encoded in the spectra of the various Laplacians on the various p forms. Now, it turns out that there are varying amounts of information in the various spectra, the various Laplacians, but there's also a lot of overlap. And the reason for that is these three equations. The Laplace operator commutes with the Hodge-Star operator. And remember what the Hodge-Star operator does. It maps p-forms into n minus p-forms. Since those two commute, there will be a very close relationship between the spectrum of the Laplacian on p-forms and the spectrum of the Laplacian on n minus p-forms. So we shouldn't expect that they carry too much different information. But then also the Laplacian commutes with the exterior derivative, which maps p-forms into p plus 1 forms. And the Laplacian commutes with the co-derivative, and the co-derivative maps p forms into p minus 1 forms. So again, we should expect that there's a relationship between the spectra on p forms and the spectra on p minus and p plus forms. So these spectra are going to be interconnected. How much is left over? Let's analyze that. So let's analyze the relationship between the spectrum of the Laplacian on p-forms to the spectrum of the Laplacian n minus p-forms and p plus 1 forms and p minus 1 forms. Let us start with the first equation that we can use, that the Laplacian commutes with the Hodge-Star operator. Well, this will go quickly. Assume that omega is a p-form, which is actually an eigenform to the Laplacian. So, you know, Laplacian acting on omega gives you some number times omega. So that's an eigenvalue of the Laplacian on p-forms. Then, from that, we can generate very easily an eigenfunction to the Laplacian on n minus p-forms. Namely, if this is an eigen p-form, then consider nu, the star of omega, which is an n minus p form, and let's apply the Laplacian to it. So if we apply the Laplacian to nu, we get Laplacian Hodge star omega, because nu is Hodge star omega. But they commute. So we can write this as hot star times Laplacian applied to omega. But that gives us just a lambda, which is a number which we can pull in front. So it's just lambda times nu. In other words, for every eigenvalue on P forms, we also have the same eigenvalue on n minus P forms. And we can even tell how the eigenforms go into, map into each other. So what that tells us is that the spectrum of the Laplacian on P forms has exactly the same amount of information as the spectrum of the Laplacian on N minus P forms. So that saves us some instrumentation, so to speak. We only need to work up to, you know, half of the P forms, and then the other half, their spectrum can be inferred. See, in principle, you know, in seismology, you have the pressure waves, you have the shear waves. But here you have all kinds of waves, P-form waves. And we don't need to have instruments for all P-forms, only for half of them. Now, let's use the other two equations. Namely that the Laplacian commutes with the exterior derivative and that the Laplacian commutes with the co-derivative. That should give us some more information about those spectra. Well, this will lead us to the famous Hodge decomposition. We start with this observation. The Laplacian maps exact forms into exact forms because of that condition. So remember what an exact form is. An exact differential form is a differential form which is the D of another differential form. And you can maybe remember that. I mean, the way I remember the terminology of exact is that, you see, not every differential form is exact. A differential form has to be of a particular shape. It has to be very particular so that it is the D of something else. So it has to be chosen very exactly. Right? So that's just how I remember it. Consider a differential form omega, which is the D of another differential form. Well, okay, what do we get when we apply the Laplacian now on omega? So the Laplacian applied to omega is then Laplacian applied to D nu, right? Because omega is D nu. But we can swap those two because of that. So we have that it's the D of Laplacian of nu. And the important thing about this is that this is an exact form, right? Because it's the D of something. It's the D of Laplacian nu. So what we have is that when we take omega to be, if for any omega that is an exact form, every omega that is of this shape has the property that when you apply the Laplacian to it, you get another exact form. So the Laplacian maps exact forms into exact forms. And this is the way to write this down most conveniently. You see, what is lambda r? Lambda r is, forget about the D for a moment, lambda r is the space of r forms. Then d lambda r is the notation we use to describe what you get when you apply the exterior derivative on all of that. It's another space, right? It's the space of exact r plus 1 forms. Okay, because lambda r is the space of all r forms. If you put the, apply the d to it, you get r plus 1 forms. And all of them are exact because they arise in this way. They're the d of something like that. So I hope you're okay with this notation that the exterior derivative is acting here on an entire set, not just on an individual differential form. This is to mean the entire set of exact r plus 1 forms. And what we just showed is that the Laplace operator is mapping exact r plus 1 forms into exact r plus 1 forms. Right? Remember that the Laplace operator is not changing the degree of a differential form. It's mapping p-forms into p-forms. So if this is a exact p-form, then that is an exact p-form. Okay, so the Laplace operator is mapping exact differential forms into exact differential forms of the same degree. Now it turns out that, very similarly, the Laplace operator also maps coexact forms into coexact forms. And by coexact, I mean a differential form omega is called coexact. I think we had that earlier. It's called coexact if it is the coderivative of a differential form. So beta in this case has to be an R minus form if omega is an R form. So very similarly to this, let's apply the Laplacian onto a differential form, and which is coexact. Then this is the Laplacian on the coderivative of beta. We can swap the Laplacian and the coderivative. We have it this way around, and there we go. This is again a coexact form because it's the coderivative on something. But that tells us yet another relationship. It tells us that the Laplacian is acting co-exact forms into co-exact forms. Well, and finally, the Laplacian may also map differential forms into zero. Let's consider that case especially as well. What is that space? Well, the space of differential forms that is mapped onto zero by the Laplacian is simply the kernel of the Laplacian, simply the eigenspace of eigenvalue zero. Remember, the Laplacian is a self-adjoint operator, and it may or may not have zero in its spectrum. The spectrum is going to be real, but a zero may or may not be in its spectrum. If it is, then that's what we're talking about here, the eigenspace to the Laplacian. By the way, we said earlier that if the manifold in question is a compact Riemannian manifold without boundary, then the spectrum is discrete. It's technically a point spectrum, even without accumulation points. That is guaranteeing for us that we really have eigenvectors that are normalizable with respect to the inner product on differential forms. That too would go away if we made the manifold infinitely large. But we're working with one that's finite. It might be gazillions of light years across, but finite. Okay, so there's a special name for differential forms that are in the kernel of the Laplacian, that are annihilated by the Laplacian. These differential forms are called harmonic forms. And the notation for them is lambda zero. So the R forms, differential R forms that are annihilated by the Laplacian are called the differential, are called the harmonic R forms. And the zero up here indicates zero eigenvalue. So the Laplacian is mapping the space of harmonic R forms into zero. Okay, so what we have is that the Laplacian is mapping exact forms, exact P forms into, or R forms into exact R forms. It's mapping coexact R forms into coexact R forms, and it's mapping harmonic R forms into zero. Eventually, of course, we want to translate that into information about the spectra and how they might be related. Okay, so the Laplacian maps this space into itself, that space into itself, and that space into zero. Is there any other space that the Laplacian acts on? It turns out, no, that's complete. And that's the famous Hodge decomposition. It turns out that the space of p-forms uniquely decomposes into exact p-forms, coexact p-forms, and harmonic p-forms, where this direct sum here indicates not only that this is the linear span of those three spaces, but also that this space is orthogonal to that space, is orthogonal to that space. So this is going to be very useful to know, especially the orthogonality here, because it means that, and remember, what we are after is the spectra, and therefore the eigenvectors. You see, an eigenvector of the Laplacian therefore has to be either completely in this space, has to be either exact, or an eigenvector has to be coexact, or an eigenvector has to be to eigenvalues zero. Right? Because the Laplacian act maps this space into itself and separately that space into itself and so on. Let's prove a little bit of this. I wrote up the entire proof, but it's probably too tedious to go into all of those proofs. Let me just show you some of the things. Okay, so it's clear that the space of exact p-forms is in particular contained in the space of all p-forms. See, exact p-forms are what this notation is, and these are the coexact p-forms, and they are, of course, in the space of all p-forms as well. One of the things we have to show, in order to show the Hodge decomposition here, one of the things we have to show is that these two guys are orthogonal to each other. Okay, so how do we see that? Well, let's assume that omega is an exact p-form. So, yes, so it's of the form that it's a D of some nu. So let's assume omega is an exact p-form and alpha is a coexact p-form. So, one of them is in here and the other one is in there. We need to show that they are orthogonal to each other. Well, then what is the inner product between them? So we take omega and alpha. Omega is exact, so it's the D of some nu. The alpha is coexact, so it's the del of some beta. And then we can use the fact that this is the adjoint operator to that, to the D, up to a minus sign. So we can move this in the inner product over to the left, but then it becomes a D. It's the adjoint. Actually becomes minus a D. But in any case, we get a D squared here, D squared nu, but that's zero. We could also have moved that over here and then used that the co-derivative squared is zero. So that's orthogonality. So we've already shown then that any exact p-form must be orthogonal to any coexact p-form. We also have to show that if omega is a p-form and omega is orthogonal to the exact forms and orthogonal to the coexact forms, then it can only be in the remainder of what the Hodge decomposition says. If a p-form is orthogonal to this space, orthogonal to that space, it's got to be a harmonic form. It's got to be in there. Right? And I leave it to you to go through the argument. It's a short one, but instructive if you do it yourself. Okay, now we also need to show that if a differential form is a harmonic p-form, then it is orthogonal to the exact p-forms and to the coexact p-forms. Shall we go through this? I think it always goes pretty much the same. I think you can see how that works. And do it as an exercise, just to get some experience in using those things. Okay, so our conclusion so far, this then completes the proof of the Hodge decomposition. So now, let's see what we have so far, because this is what matters here. Remember, the Hodge decomposition says that the space of p-forms is the direct sum of the space of exact p-forms plus the space of coexact p-forms plus the harmonic forms that are annihilated by the Laplacian. And the same is true for the p minus 1 forms, right? It's direct sum of the exact ones plus the coexact ones plus the harmonic forms. It's true for all p, right? From lambda 0 to lambda n. All of those spaces of p forms decompose according to the Hodge decomposition into exact forms plus coexact forms plus harmonic forms. Just a sec, I was wondering. There is something important I want to show you in there. Okay. Let's go through this proof here. Okay, so we want to show that if a form is harmonic, then it is orthogonal to the exact forms, orthogonal to the coexact forms. Okay, so assume that omega is a harmonic p-form. So it's annihilated by the Laplace operator, which is to say that, you know, this is the Laplace operator. Acting on omega is equal to zero. And that means in particular that since this part alone is zero, if I take the inner product with omega again, that's also zero. Now, let us spell this out. You see, this is two terms, really. And for each one of those terms, we can move, in this case, the d over to that side, and in that case, the del over to that side. And so this expression becomes the sum of those two expressions. But that is the norm squared of a vector. And that is the norm squared of a vector. So both of them are positive. But since the sum of them is equal to zero, each one individually is vanishing. And from that, we can tell that the co-derivative of omega must be vanishing, and the exterior derivative of omega must also be vanishing. So we have co-derivative of omega is equal to zero, and exterior derivative of omega is equal to zero. So what we can conclude from this so far is that every harmonic form is automatically obeying that the co-derivative of it is equal to zero. But what does that mean? It means that it is co-closed. And the fact that the exterior derivative of it acting on it is zero means that it is closed. Right? Remember the difference between closed and exact differential forms. If the space is contractible, then they are the same, but generally that's not the same. Okay, so what we have here is that harmonic forms are closed and co-closed. If they're annihilated, a form, differential form that's annihilated by the Laplace operator will obey these two conditions. So it's closed and co-closed. But we didn't show that they are exact or co-exact. In fact, We showed earlier, not in this proof, but a slide above, we showed that they are not exact and not coexact. But what does that mean? It means that a harmonic form is going to be closed and co-closed, but not exact and not coexact. And that means that the harmonic forms, the very existence of harmonic forms, indicates non-trivial topology. Because if you have a trivial topology in the manifold, then we know that every closed form is also exact, and every exact form is also closed. But in a non-trivial topology, that may not be true. Every exact form is always closed, but not every closed form is exact. And similarly with co-exact and co-closed. So we can only have harmonic forms if the space is non-trivial, if the manifold on which this is happening is non-trivial. That's why the dimension of the space of harmonic forms, of harmonic p-forms, tells us something about how non-trivial the underlying manifold is, whether it has holes and handles, and things like that. The dimension of the space of harmonic p-forms is called BP, and B because these numbers are called the Betti numbers. So the Betti numbers are the dimension of the space of, the p's Betti number is the dimension of the space of p-forms. Dimension of the space of harmonic p-forms. Okay, the remainder of the proof I leave to you. We don't need to spend time on that. I just wanted to make sure I cover the definition of the Betti numbers. Not that we would need it later on, but we talked about cohomology earlier and about methods for detecting non-trivial topology. In a manifold, you see that by checking for harmonic forms, you can check for non-trivial topology of the manifold. Okay, so the Hodge decomposition tells us that the space of p-forms always decomposes into exact p-forms plus co-exact p-forms plus harmonic forms, if there are any. Okay, now, the Laplace operator is going to map each one of those subspaces into itself. The Laplace operator is going to map that space into itself. It's going to map space, that space into itself, this space into itself. Because remember, we showed that early on. The Laplace operator is mapping exact forms into exact forms, co-exact forms into co-exact forms, and, well, harmonic forms into zero. So the Laplace operator has a spectrum on this space. It has a spectrum on that space, a spectrum on this space. Well, it's zero. But the degeneracy is still interesting because this degeneracy is the degeneracy of the eigenvalue zero of the Laplacian p-forms is the p's Betti number, which tells us about the topology of the space. Okay, so the Laplacian has a spectrum on this space, spectrum on that space, spectrum on this and that. It has separate spectra on each of those. It maps these spaces into themselves separately. And the Laplacian is zero on all of those spaces. So let's see, what can we tell about the spectra on those individual spaces and how much of them is independent information, just like shear waves and pressure waves, and how much is really related to each other. So we're going to look at the spectrum of the Laplacian on exact R form, or in this case, R plus 1 forms, the spectrum of the Laplacian on co-exact forms, and the spectrum of the Laplacian on harmonic forms is, of course, always zero. So we are interested in these spectra there. Turns out that these spectra are indeed related. And in particular, the spectrum of the Laplacian on exact R plus 1 forms, right, because lambda R is R forms, but d lambda R is R plus 1 forms, is actually the same as the spectrum of the Laplacian on the co-exact R forms. And for each the eigenvectors map into each other as well. So before we prove that, let me explain what that means. What that means is that when we take the Hodge decomposition for each one of the spaces of p-forms from zero forms up here to n forms down there, then what we find is that the space of P forms, as usual decomposed into exact, coexact, and harmonic forms, has the property that the spectrum of the Laplacian on those P forms, on the exact P forms, is actually identical to the spectrum of the Laplacian onto those coexact forms. And similarly, the spectrum of the Laplacian on these exact forms is going to be the same as the spectrum of the Laplacian on those coexact forms. So that means not separate information. They carry the same information, these spectra. But let's prove that. So assume that the Laplacian is, let's assume that lambda is an eigenvector of the Laplacian on R plus one forms. With an eigenvector, let's assume lambda is an eigenvalue and lambda is its eigenvector. Then let us consider the co-derivative of this omega, call it nu. That's going to be in this space, obtained by taking the co-derivative of the space of R plus one forms. Because omega is in the space of R plus one forms, if you apply the co-derivative on it, then you have that. Now let's apply the Laplace operator on the nu. We can exchange, I mean, the nu is really just the del omega. We can exchange those two because they commute. Then, as we did earlier, the Laplacian on omega gives us the eigenvalue. We can pull that in front, and we get that nu is an eigenvector with eigenvalue lambda. So that means we started out with an eigenvector with eigenvalue lambda, where the eigenvector was an exact R plus one form. And now we constructed in nu an eigenvector of the Laplacian, which is in the space of coexact R forms. And the converse works as well. But again, let me skip that. It's same way of calculating that. So that proves that claim here, namely that the spectrum on this space is the same as the spectrum on that space. Now, let us use what we established up front, namely that because of the commutativity of the Laplacian with the Hodge star operator, we have that there's a close relationship, in fact, identity between the spectra on P forms and N minus P forms. Remember, the Hodge star is mapping P forms into N minus P forms, and we can prove the proposition that it maps exact R plus one forms into coexact N minus R minus one forms. Let's prove that. Assume that omega is an exact R plus one form, so it's the D of some row. Then we define nu to be the star of that omega. Then we apply, then the nu is star of D row. And we can put two stars in here, because remember that the Hodge star, after the Hodge star, is giving you almost the identity up to high powers of minus one. You know, the star, Hodge star maps P forms into N minus P forms, and then do that again, you get back into P forms. If you do that, if you put two stars in here, then you get a star D star, which is the co-derivative. And so what we obtain is that this is the co-derivative of some alpha, But that's what we needed to show, that it is a coexact form. And similarly, you can show this, an analogon to that for the coderivative. Okay. But we already showed that the hot star, early on we showed that, preserved the spectrum of the Laplacian. Now we just showed that it also maps in particular the exact into coexact spaces. So this is what we had so far. We had that the spectrum on this space is the same as the spectrum on that space. Now, from what we just established, we also have a sort of mirror symmetry in the spectra. Imagine zero forms up there, n forms down there, and then let's consider the p forms and the n minus p forms. They're related by the hot star. And what we find, what we just found with what we just proved here, is that the spectrum on this space is the same as the spectrum on that space. And this spectrum is the same as that spectrum. Equal color means equal spectrum. Here the spectrum is always zero, of course. Right? So now we have even more relationships between the spectra of the Laplace operator. Becomes very restrictive now. Okay, so you see that, for example, in the case of four-dimensional space-time, I mean, assuming we consider it as a Riemannian manifold now, a four-dimensional compact Riemannian manifold, what we have then is that, for example, zero forms and four forms would be forming such a pair, and you would have this relationship. But also one forms and three forms have that relationship. Let's work it out explicitly in the case of three-dimensional manifolds to see how much information do we really get inspired by the seismology analogy. Well, not that much. You see, the space of zero forms doesn't contain exact forms, because a zero form is never the D of another form. It would have to be a minus one form or something, right? So zero forms have only consist of the space of coexact forms plus harmonic forms potentially, and then the usual Hodge decomposition. And then on a three-dimensional manifold, the space of n forms, in this case three forms, can only have exact forms in it, but not coexact forms, because they would have to be the D of something that's four-dimensional. But our manifold only has three dimensions. And what we saw from the Hodge star analysis was that the spectrum on this space has to be the same as the spectrum on that space. Spectrum on this space, same as on that, that, and that. So what we see here is that equal color means equal spectrum. So there is the blue spectrum and there's the red spectrum. There's actually relatively little information there. In fact, if you consider only scalar waves in three dimensions, only scalar waves, then you are only getting this spectral information, and you're definitely missing out by not measuring vector waves. But if you measure vector waves only, then you get both the blue spectrum and the red spectrum, and you have everything. You have this spectrum and all the others. So in fact, it suffices in principle to measure the spectrum of vectorial waves in three dimensions, and you get all spectral information that you could possibly have. Except you can't tell them necessarily, depends on the instrumentation, whether an eigenvalue belongs to this or that. For that, you would also have to find the eigenvectors. But we're only interested in the eigenvalues, and if we do so, then, well, you get the scalar spectrum from here, and then the red spectrum from there. But you see, it's a bit disappointing. There's not much information in there. And if you go to higher dimensions, to four, as if, let's say, for space-time, then you don't get that much more. In fact, I leave it to you as an exercise to work it out for four. You don't get that much more information. Which is a bit surprising, perhaps, but that's how it is. Now,
Saying that the number of choices available is very limited for this, like you can characterize, or does this really not give you much information?
Well, okay, strictly speaking, the only thing that we can conclude from this is that looking at different kinds of waves doesn't enhance the benefit much. But it could be, of course, that this is completely sufficient already, right? We haven't established that yet, okay? Okay, so then it turns out in the literature, just give me a, let me give you a bit of an overview. It turns out in the literature that actually those spectra don't suffice. They don't. And there are counterexamples. There are examples, for example, of high-dimensional tori, which are different but have the same spectra. Now, it turns out, though, that those counterexamples are, as far as physics is concerned, of relatively limited significance. These are manifolds that are locally, if not globally, not isometric. Manifolds that are isospectral only with respect to some of the Laplacians, but maybe not all of them. Manifolds that are, for example, discrete pairs. That wouldn't be so bad for quantization. As long as you have just a finite redundancy, it's not so bad. I mean, for example, if you take a potato and its mirror image, clearly they will have the same spectrum. Nothing you can do about that. Except if you work, for example, with spin waves can, under certain circumstances, as we will see later, distinguish left from right. Then the spectrum could tell you whether you work with a left-handed or a right-handed potato, or with a potato or its mirror image. But we don't do spin just yet. Okay, but let me tell you in just a few slides quickly about a fresh approach that I introduced to the field of spectral geometry. You see, what we did was all perfectly exact and clean and all proven and so on. And this is how pure mathematics, of course, proceeds. You have a conjecture, you prove it, or you disprove it, or you don't do anything about it. But as physicists, we can try perturbation theory. So I was interested in, you know, how bad is it? Can we overcome that? Is there a way to make it unique? Is there a way to actually get to the manifold from just the spectra? Maybe there's something we overlooked. How come it is not sufficient, the information that we can glean from those spectra? Okay, and so here's the idea. First of all, you need to be a bit more modest, or just a bit more careful. Instead of trying to solve the full spectral geometry problem at once, let's do it in tiny steps. So the full spectral geometry problem is this. Given the spectra, I calculate the shape for you. Too hard. Nobody can do that. It's too nonlinear. You know, from just the spectrum going to the, even if it is possible, it would have to be highly nonlinear. Nobody can do that. So what I thought is, let's simplify the problem. Assume you're given the spectrum and you're given the shape. You don't have to calculate the one from the other. You're given both. But then somebody changes the shape of the manifold just a little bit, just infinitesimally. That will change the spectra also only infinitesimally. And now the task that we put ourselves is this. If we are told only the small change in spectrum, can we calculate what the small change of shape was? You see, it's no longer arbitrary spectrum, get the shape. No, from a small change of spectrum, can we calculate the small change of shape? The benefit is that this is linear. If it's infinitesimal, it's first order, it's linear. We're basically considering the tangent map to what used to be a very nonlinear map. Okay, so let's do that. So let's say both the manifold and its spectra are given. So this is a compact Riemannian manifold without a boundary, and these are some spectra of Laplacians on the manifold. But let us allow to use Laplacians not just on p-forms, but Laplacians on any tensors. This will turn out to be important. We only looked at p-forms. there can be other waves than p-form waves on a manifold as well. This will actually be the way out. So we do a perturbative analysis. Let us change the shape of the manifold slightly by perturbing the metric. So we let the metric go into the metric plus some small perturbation h. This will slightly change the spectra in a highly nonlinear way, but just for this analysis, we can certainly already conclude that the eigenvalues, the spectra, see, I labels the Laplacian, you know, Laplacian on scalars, Laplacian on three tensors or whatever, and n labels the eigenvalues for that spectrum. So those spectra will be perturbed by some discrete set of numbers as well. Now, why is that useful? Well, it turns out that we can expand this process in a basis and get coefficients for this expansion, where we for this perturbation. Here we have coefficients for the perturbation of the spectrum. Here we will have coefficients for the perturbations of the shape. And there will exist a linear map from these coefficients of shape change to these coefficients of spectrum change. And our task is to see if that linear map is invertible. Because then we can calculate small shape changes from small spectral changes. And if we succeed with that, we have a shot at solving the original problem. Because we can then try to iterate this. We can iterate infinitesimal spectral geometry to arrive at finite spectral geometry. So you change the spectrum little by little by little towards a target spectrum. All along, you're changing the shape little by little by little, and you arrive at the target shape. But along the way, we should find out why it is that there were ambiguities, why the spectra that we considered so far were not sufficient. Well, here is how we find out what the problem was. Define a self-adjoint Laplace operator on the space of covariant two tensors. That's not one of the Laplace operators that we've considered so far. We've only defined Laplace operators on differential forms. Two tensors are not differential forms in general. Like the metric is not a differential form. Now, this Laplace operator, we make sure it's a self-adjoint second order differential operator acting on the space of two forms, covariantly defined. There are ways to do this. We will talk about this later. So we have a self-adjoint Laplace operator acting on the space of two tensors, or did I say two forms, two tensors such as the metric. And then by the spectral theorem, it will have an eigenbasis, an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. Let's call those two tensors Bn of x. So we have now a decomposition of the self-adjoint Laplacian on two tensors, and this is the eigenbasis of it. In fact, we could restrict the tension to just the symmetric two tensors because the metric is of that kind. Okay, so now we have this expansion of the metric in terms of its Laplacian. And that means that we can expand the perturbation of the metric in that basis. Remember, this was the perturbation of the metric. We have a perturbation of the shape, the metric, and we have a perturbation of the spectra. Okay? So now, to parameterize the change of spectrum is very easy, just some coefficients, some numbers by which the eigenvalues change a little bit. But how do we parameterize the change of the metric? Well, we can do it canonically in the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator. So let's do this. So the H is the perturbation of the metric. It's a covariant symmetric two tensor. It has an expansion in terms of the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator. And so what we now have is the eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator on symmetric two tensors. And here these coefficients describe the change of shape. So if you want a manifold to grow a bump or a dent, then you have to add h to its metric. And you can specify your h by specifying this bunch of numbers here. the coefficients in the expansion. And as you do that, you change the sound of the manifold. So the eigenvalues of this Laplacian on two tensors, and symmetric covariant two tensors, the eigenvalues will change as your manifold grows a bump or a dent. Okay, so as you pick numbers here, you will induce numbers over there. Right? You change the shape by perturbing G by H, and you change correspondingly the sound to get this change in the spectrum. Therefore, there's got to be a linear map, because it's infinitesimal to infinitesimal. It's got to be a linear map that maps these bunch of numbers into that bunch of numbers. Okay, so our manifold here maybe used to be smooth. Now it grows a pimple. The spectrum used to be this spectrum. But as the manifold grows a bump, the spectrum changes a little bit. You know, this eigenvalue goes into that eigenvalue, this eigenvalue goes to that eigenvalue, and so on. So here we have a change of the metric into G plus H. Here we have a change of the spectrum from lambda going into lambda plus the mu's. And overall, we obtain a linear map of those coefficients Hn into those coefficients mu n. Change of shape, change of spectrum. And explicitly, there's some matrix SNM that does it. And we know it must exist, because every change, if you change the shape, it will change the spectrum. The question is the invertibility of it. Now, in practice, we may want to consider a cutoff. Let us consider not arbitrarily high eigenvectors, arbitrarily high eigenvalues, but only eigenvalues up to a certain cutoff. The physics of this is that we do not allow to grow arbitrarily small bumps on the manifold, but no, we only consider the first, I don't know, gazillion of eigenfunctions. That allows us a limited range of the bumps that can be grown. You know, the higher you go with the eigenvalues, the smaller is the wavelength of the eigenfunctions. Or in other words, it's as if we had finite vision. We cannot really resolve with our eyes exactly the tiniest of ripples onto the manifold. So let's say we have finite vision. And that also corresponds to, because it's a cutoff on the spectrum, it also corresponds to a finite amount of hearing. The physics of it, the fundamental physics of it, would be, of course, a natural ultraviolet cutoff at the Planck scale. The assumption that there are no wavelengths smaller than such and such, there are no frequencies higher than so and so. That makes it easier to analyze the invertibility of this problem. So let's say we work up to a very high value of the spectrum, but not infinity. It could be as high as you want, but not infinity. Well, but then what we have is that the matrix S becomes a square matrix. Because if you take into account degeneracies, there are always exactly as many eigenvalues as there are eigenvectors. So it's a square matrix. That's good. There's a chance that it might be invertible. And in fact, generically, this should be a generic matrix, a generic n by n matrix, if we take the first n eigenvalues. And generically, the determinant has no reason to vanish. There's a bit of a subtle argument there, but it's not something that would invalidate the argument. And therefore, generically, you should be able to invert it. And generically, you should therefore be able to go backwards. And therefore, you should normally be able to calculate a small change of shape from the corresponding small change of sound, just inverting that matrix. So this is calculating from a change of shape what the change of sound is. But if you have S inverse, you can calculate the change of shape knowing the change of sound. Now, now, what about the ambiguities that we had discussed earlier? We know from just, you know, from the literature, we know that if you were to look just at the spectra of the Laplacian and differential forms, that cannot be sufficient. Cannot be sufficient to nail down exactly which Riemannian manifold we are working with. What is special about using instead the spectra that we are using here. We are here using the spectrum, or the spectra, of a Laplacian that acts on symmetric covariant two tensors. And in fact, just this one spectrum of this one Laplacian and symmetric covariant two tensors. That's certainly different from the spectra that we considered earlier, spectra of the differential form. But you see, what's special here is that the okay, let me discuss the relationship between the two. It turns out that the perturbations of the metric can be decomposed into three parts. Into a part that is of scalar origin, into a part that is of vectorial origin, and a part that's truly tensorial. Now, you may have heard of that, that in the cosmic microwave background, in principle, there are scalar perturbations, vectorial perturbations, tensorial perturbations. For example, what BICEP2 was looking for in cosmology was gravitational waves. They would have been tensorial perturbations of the metric. Whereas what we see as temperature distribution, as the temperature map of the cosmic microwave background, that is the scalar, originates mostly in the scalar perturbations of the metric. There's a bit of a cross interaction between the scalar and the tensorial part, and in cosmology we expect that there is no contribution from the vectorial part. But you know, this goes beyond what we can cover in this course. But the Laplacian on symmetric covariant two tensors, like the metric, decomposes in effect into three Laplacians. The Laplacian on what is effectively a scalar degrees of freedom, vectorial ones, and tensorial ones. And the scalar part we get also from the differential forms, differential zero forms. The vectorial part we can get possibly from the one forms. But there is a remaining tensorial part that the Laplacian on metrics knows about. But no Laplacian on differential forms knows about that. That's extra information. So the way we, so this tells us that we can only possibly succeed in having a one-to-one map between small changes of shape and small changes of sound is if we listen to not just any kind of waves that the manifold might support, but we need to listen to those kinds of waves, the spectrum of that kind of wave that the metric itself supports. And these are symmetric covariant two tensor waves. Right? The metric can be perturbed by that. Perturbing the metric is exactly the same as what vibrations of the metric are doing, what vibrations of the manifold are doing. So we should not care about vibrations in terms of P forms, where P is 3 or whatever, because the manifold itself doesn't have that as a degree of freedom. It's what we should care about is the sound and the perturbations that the metric itself has. So we would need symmetric covariant two tensors. Anyway, starting from here, roughly, I gave a talk in September in this room as part of a conference, and here is the link to that talk, and have a listen to that. You will see how this all fits into the physics of it, and that talk is less technical than what we did in this course, so you can certainly follow what's going on in there. It's all about the physics of it, whereas here we did the math of it. All right. Okay, so, and I should say that with a student, and that is a later talk in the same conference, with a student we actually tried it out. So we said, okay, let's do that for explicit examples, and we calculated shapes from sound, both for curvature, but also for the detection of boundaries and so on. So it actually works.
What's the difficulty of pseudo-Riemannian?
Well, the metric in the inner product in the space of differential forms is no longer positive. And so assumptions of self-adjointness and orthogonality, especially orthogonality, will not hold. And that is a problem. Yeah. So in order to apply this to space-time, there are two strategies. I'm pursuing both. One is to do it, to make a huge effort and try to overcome those problems with the indefinite inner product and so on. That's one way of doing it. And the other way of doing it is to rely on Vick rotation, which is an analytic continuation of the time variable so that it becomes like a space variable. And then instead of working with the pseudo-Riemannian manifold, you work with a Riemannian manifold where you can use those tools. Difficult part is to get back then from that to the Lorentzian case. But it's, I mean, this sort of thing, the Vick rotation is done routinely. It just hasn't been applied to this approach yet. So a lot is known about it. Okay, sorry, I went over time, but I do have some time for questions if you have some.
Okay, and the next thing.